Our next matter is Charles Cradiville versus City of New Brunswick. May we have appearances, please?
Good morning. Alexander Shalom from Lowenstein Sandler, along with the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey, I represent Charles Cradiville.
Good morning, Your Honor. Frank Corrado, I'm here for several friends of the court, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, and several media organizations, Gannett, the Media News Group, the New Jersey Press Association, and New Jersey Advanced Media.
Good morning, Your Honors. Susan O'Connor, Hoagland, Longa, Moran, Dunstan, Dukas. I represent the defendant, City of New Brunswick, and former Director Caputo.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Zuckerman on behalf of the Attorney General as amicus.
Thank you, counsel. If we don't finish the argument by 12:30, we'll take a half hour break at that time. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court if I might reserve 2 or 3 minutes?
Sure.
Thank you. This case asks a simple question about whether the government can provide information to a reporter and then later attempt to punish the reporter for reporting that same information in a story about an issue of public concern. It cannot. I'd like to do 3 things in the argument today. First, I'd like to talk about how the lower courts erred in their analysis of whether or not the matter was one of public significance. Then I'd like to go through the other elements of the Daily Mail test, whether it was true and lawfully obtained. And finally, I'll apply the Daily Mail test to decide whether there is a need of the highest order and whether that whether the law is narrowly tailored to achieve that purpose. Before I get to those 3 points, though, I'd like to talk about what this case is not about. This is not a facial challenge to Daniel's Law. It does not ask whether there are any conceivable constitutional applications. It simply asks whether it is constitutional on these peculiar facts. The case also does not question whether Judge Salas and her family have suffered greatly. The case does not question whether Judge Salas has fought heroically in her son's honor. And the case does not question whether the government may do something to try to keep judges and other public officials safe. The answer to those last 3 questions is unequivocally yes, and Mr. Cradiville has not challenged that finding at any point in this litigation. That said, I'll start with the question of public importance. The law on this is very straightforward. The courts have been crystal clear that the test is whether or not the contested fact concerns a matter of public interest, whether it involves a matter of public significance. In other words, the test is relational. The lower courts and the city and the attorney general take a different view. They take a necessity view. They want to ask whether the particular fact is necessary or whether it's superfluous to the story. But that is not what the United States Supreme Court has done in any of the cases. And I should say, they're also wrong as a matter of fact about whether or not this is a matter of public concern. The Attorney General proposes that we ask whether there's any residual public interest in the matter. And the Appellate Division says, well, we have this common sense solution that will work for everyone. Mr. Cradiville can just say where, what city the director lives in, and no more.
So how far does that go, Mr. Shalom? Let's say there is a organized crime trial, and it's presided over by a trial judge. And the reporter, for whatever editorial reasons, wants to say, Judge Smith was the trial judge, and he lives at 124 Main Street in town X. Now, he's the trial judge. It has his residence is part of his persona. It's part of his existence. Does that fall within the definition as you claim it should be applied?
So that need not fall within the definition. If I might explain where I think the court is bound. In the Florida Star, the court said, look, we're not going to ask about the specific fact. We're going to ask about the issue generally. They rejected the idea that we're going to look fact by fact and instead kind of imposed this relational test. Now, sometimes—
Obviously, very distinguishable situation, Florida Star.
Sure, every case is decided on its own facts, and particularly
understood.
That.
Understood. What we, but please go just.
I'm going to answer your question directly.
Okay.
Sometimes the nexus between two things is, yes, they're theoretically related, as you just described, right? It's part of who the judge is, but not really an intimate part of the case. But when the nexus is at least as close as it was in the Florida Star.
But you're taking a very broad view of what related means in your brief. It is so why is it that address could, I think you're arguing, could potentially be required to be withheld from that article when you're also telling us not that it's inappropriate for courts to look into the purpose of an article and essentially become what you would say is an editor. Why is it that if Mr. Cradwell is right in this case, that a reporter could not gratuitously put a judge's home address into every article that involves that judge?
So let me try and take your question in two parts. The first is on the, does my brief take a broad view? In my brief, I cite to a series of cases that do take a broad view about what it means to be related to. And then I say, and the court need not adopt that view. All the court needs to do is say that the relationship between Director Caputo's home address and the distance he lives from his place of employment, that the nexus between those two is at least as close as the nexus that was found sufficient in the Florida Star. So in the Florida Star, the issue of public concern was crime, violent crime, and rape. And the specific fact was the name of a particular victim. And the court found those two things sufficiently related. And here what we have is the distance that Director Caputo lives from New Brunswick, everyone agrees, is a matter of public significance.
Let me refine the hypothetical. Let's say the hypothetical is that the judge has been threatened and there's a charge for threatening a judge. And the reporter decides to include the judge's home address, perhaps to indicate whether it's really a geographical location in which the defendant could likely have committed some violence, just for whatever reason. That seems to have some nexus to the charge of threatening to come to the judge's home and do harm. So is that address within the scope of your rule?
That becomes a closer question, but let me be very clear. This is an as-applied challenge. I'm not asking for a rule. I'm asking for permission for Mr. Cradwell to write the article that he intends to write.
But even in an as-applied challenge, there is a request for a rule.
And what I'm suggesting is there are courts out there that have taken a capacious view of what a matter of public interest is as it relates to home addresses, and the court need not go that far. It only need go as far, and in fact, it must go as far as the Florida Star went. And so if you find that the nexus between where he lived, the distance between his home and his work and his actual address, if that nexus is closer than rape in general and a victim's name, then the Florida Star mandates that my client have that the Daily Mail principle applies and we get to steps 2, 3, and ultimately the narrow tailoring.
Just show up, your brief and those on your side put a lot of significance on the decision-making of a records custodian. We have 500 or so municipalities in New Jersey, 21 counties,
a school board,
a number of state agencies that have people that on a full-time or part-time basis perform the role of a records custodian. As I understand your side's position, that you read the case law, First Amendment case law, that if it's lawfully obtained from such a records custodian, either you're entitled to publish it or you have a very strong First Amendment interest in publishing. But systemically, I'm wondering, bearing in mind some of the things this court said in Gannett Satellite, about the training and qualifications of records custodians, does it make sense to place in this case or other cases so much significance on what a particular records custodian decides to do in evaluating whether there's a sufficient relation or public interest? Are they really well informed to give consistent and dependable assessments of all that? Long question, but I think you're following.
I think I follow you. And Judge Sabatino, to be fair, I planned to address this question as I went to the lawfully obtained prong, but let me just move there right now, because let's think about the Florida Star. You're going to hear me talking a lot about this case because it's a very strong case for us. In the Florida Star, it was a clerk in the police department who left the report on the in the press room. So there are certainly more clerks in municipal police departments in or employees in municipal police departments in Florida than there are clerks here. There's been a lot of talk that this case is different because this was obtained through OPRA rather than in a public courtroom or something like that. And I agree it's different. And I think it counsels in Mr. Cradiville's favor for the following reason. Clerks may be poorly trained. Clerks might not face liability, but they can. We have other statutes out there that require training, auditing, and impose liability for negligent disclosure. So I'm thinking particularly about the expungement statute. Daniel's Law has none of those elements. So they're not, this gets exactly to what Florida Star was talking about, which is if the government isn't making an effort to safeguard this information in the first place, it can hardly be said that they've taken the least onerous path, the most narrowly.
Mr. Cradiville contend that the clerk was negligent in releasing the document to him?
That is an open question, Justice Patterson. Let me explain.
I'm not asking you for fact finding. Is it his contention that she was negligent?
It is his contention that if Director Caputo had availed himself of the opt-in to Daniel's Law at the time that Mr. Cradiville made the request, then yes, the clerk was negligent. But that key fact is not part of the record in this case. And so we don't know that the clerk erred at all.
But we do know there was an exchange. There was a process that went on between Mr. Cradiville and the clerk. Am I correct that the first version of this that was produced redacted the information that we are here talking about?
That is correct.
And that your client made an argument that the clerk was relying on precedent that was overturned.
That is also correct.
From this court.
Correct.
And was that true?
I don't think that's the best reading of Brennan. I think that's fair to say that if Mr. Cradiville were an attorney and we were critiquing the legal advice that he gave, it was not the correct legal advice. That doesn't mean that the clerk erred. And it certainly, as we get to the question about lawfully obtained, does not mean that Mr. Cradiville either violated the law, because people can make their arguments on why they are entitled to things under OPRA all the time. And if the clerk listens, that's not the proponent's fault that they've—
Well, I think that, you know, the OPRA law would suggest there should be a dialogue. But it does reflect on one of your three suggestions on how this problem can be effectively resolved, and that is the training of clerks. When the redaction would have eliminated this issue, and then your client came back with a legal argument as to the significance of one of our cases, OPRA cases.
Right, but the onus then is on the clerk to go to their independent counsel that they have, or to go to the Government Records Council help page. There's a million resources for the clerk to use. The clerk chose not to and provided the information to Mr. Cradiville, which gets me to an important—
And none of the discussion was about Daniel's Law, correct? The back and forth was not that Mr. Cradiville was alleged to have said something legally incorrect about Daniel's Law, and then the clerk, you know, negligently or not negligently accepted it. This was a totally separate thing that had absolutely nothing to do with Daniel's Law.
That is absolutely correct. And so let me put another kind of framing gloss on this, which is there's the entire Daily Mail line of cases, which talks about when journalists have obtained information that is true and they've done so lawfully, whether the government may prohibit or punish the lawful publication of it. There's a subset of those cases that deals with when it is the government itself that provides the information. And the courts have been even more absolute in those cases to say, when the government itself provides the information, it's really difficult. Thus far, they haven't found an instance where they can, where for the government to then punish you for publishing that which they already provided. They cannot provide it. And incidentally, that's a part of Daniel's Law that is not challenged here. Whether or not the government may withhold certain records, they can under Daniel's Law. And it gets to the question of the facial versus as applied challenge. And so There's some talk in the briefs about the Atlas data privacy cases, which are the facial challenges that were before the district court. And when the court found in Atlas that home addresses are not facially matters of public concern, that doesn't mean that they're never matters of public concern. It means they're not always matters of public concern. And Judge Bartle, in fact, invited as-applied challenges. That's exactly what we have here, an instance where someone says, I've got a reason I need to publish this. So if I can move to the question of, is this a common sense solution that works for everyone? I note in my supplemental brief that after the city prevailed at the appellate division, the city put forth a press release where they impugned the reporting of Mr. Cradiville. They said, listen, Director Caputo, sure, he has a place in Cape May, but he really spends his time in Middlesex County. He has a pied-à-terre in one place, and he spends his weekdays here, and he shows up for all the meetings, despite what Mr. Cradiville had intended to report. And it's just not true, and it's because Mr. Cradiville's disgruntled and he has a vendetta against us. More or less, that's what the press release said. So a good journalist can respond to that by doing more reporting, by saying, okay, well, you say you're in Middlesex County every weekday. I'm going to talk to your neighbors. I'm going to talk to your neighbors in Cape May. I'm going to talk to your neighbors in Middlesex. I'm going to figure out whether that's true or not. But Mr. Cradiville can't do that. He's been essentially ordered to have this fight with a hand tied behind his back, but the city is punching away. And he shouldn't have to wait to respond till they've punched. He can do that in the first instance to put facts into his story that add to its veracity.
I'm having trouble understanding. I read this argument in your briefs that he can't move forward with this investigative journalism, can't speak to anyone. I'm having trouble understanding why that's the case.
Let me take a stab at it then, Justice Pierre-Louis. To be clear, he can speak to anyone he wants. It's reporting on it. So he can do the investigation. The question is whether he can then include those facts. So
facts that Caputo lives in Cape May.
That I spoke to
someone who lives on his street, and that person indicated that he is there 5 days a week throughout the year.
So let me give you an example. There was reporting since the inception of this case about a United States Supreme Court justice who flew particular flags at his New Jersey beach house. And in the reporting on that case, they interviewed neighbors. How often was it up? When did it go up? Right. This was clearly an issue of public concern. And part of that is reporting neighbors. And you can name the neighbors, and you can name how close they live to the particular flag in question. And so too here, it's one thing to say one of his neighbors, it's another thing to say the person who lives next door to him. And now let's say that the person who lives next door to him has a unique name. I don't think we want to have a rule that says you can always report on protected people under Daniel's Law's neighbors' addresses, just not their addresses. That's a weird rule. I think it's better for everyone to have a rule that is cabined to when it's an issue of public concern, and we decide it relates to that because the test is relational, then courts don't get involved in deciding which fact may and may not be reported upon.
But there's nothing to stop that report in the way that you've described to be issued. That article can go out exactly how you described, just without the address.
I'm not sure that's true. Again, if the question is, can someone who's up to no good derive the protected person's home address? If you're providing the name, the full name of the next door neighbor, and you're allowed to say it's their next door neighbor, I think you've kind of given away the farm on the efficacy of Daniel's Law at that point. And again,
you're suggesting that would be a violation of Daniel's Law in and of itself.
I'm suggesting it would be unclear to Mr. Cradiville, and it would prevent him, who's kind of trying to go about this in the most responsible way possible, from reporting on from the most fulsome reporting possible, because he would fear that he would be subjecting himself to liability under Daniel's Law. What he knows right now is he can write an article that says Director Caputo lives in Cape May. Additional facts: he lives in a 12-bedroom apartment or whatever, or it's a
because the statute specifically says that it's not unlawful only to disclose, but also to disclose or redisclose on the internet or otherwise make available.
I think
under the statute, you're arguing that this could be or otherwise make available.
Yes. And to be fair, I'm certainly not conceding that point. I'm not suggesting that I wouldn't give a vigorous defense to Mr. Cradiville if he opted to publish facts that otherwise made available Director Caputo's home address that he had not. But I don't think he can do so without any fear that he might be subject to repercussion.
There's really no question here that the issue is not about interviewing neighbors. The issue is about disclosure of the actual address, which everyone concedes is a violation of Daniel's law.
Let me give an example, Justice Patterson. And I know nothing about where anyone lives, but so on my block, if I said, Mr. Shalom lives in the smallest house on the block, it's the most ramshackle one, it's the only one, whatever. If I described it in ways that made it the only one, you're telling people where I live.
That's
without
the issue before. The issue before us, and this goes to the article that he would have written. The issue before us is the disclosure of the address.
So let me step back.
It's not about whether descriptives and other factors and neighbors' names would have led someone through.
To be clear, that is a secondary and supplemental argument. If you reject that, if you think, well, he certainly can describe the house in vivid detail, he can talk about the neighbors with whom he met, that's fine. We still have the fundamental problem, which is that the lower courts and the city and the attorney general are failing to use the relational test that is mandated by the Florida Star.
So tell us the principle, the way you would like to see the court explain the relational test of Florida Star as applied to Daniel's law that would, as you suggested, somehow leave out the case where a trial judge who is in the middle of an organized crime trial has their address disclosed.
I think what the court could say is the appropriate test is relational. We are going to look at the issue in general rather than the specific fact, because that is direct language from Florida Star. And then say, but the question is, what does it mean to have a relationship? What nexus is required? And we hold that the relationship must be at least as close as in the Florida Star. In this case, the distance one lives between one's home and one's work, their home address is a necessary component of that general issue and therefore has a much tighter nexus than that which was required in the Florida Star. But when the nexus is more remote than in the Florida Star, it may not. We'll have to evaluate that case separately.
Where do you get that from Florida Star? Because I saw Florida Star more as the Supreme Court looking at the news article as a whole.
Right.
Saying that it involves a matter of public significance because, quote, the article generally, as opposed to the specific identity contained within it, involved a matter of paramount public import, colon, the commission and investigation of a violent crime. And then just saying, and it's up to the editors to decide what can or cannot go into that article. Where did they specifically discuss the victim's identity and how close of a nexus that is or is not to the commission and investigation of a violent crime?
So to be clear, it's exactly the passage that you just read, Justice Wainwright, is the one upon which I rely. They don't discuss that, but what we know is they found the nexus close enough there. They said, we're gonna look at.
Or maybe they didn't even require a nexus. To me, when I read it, it made it seem more like it's the level of generality at which you are deciding if this is a matter of public concern. So they decided, we are not going to ask whether this victim's name, even though the statute only prohibits the release of a victim's name, we are not going to ask, is this specific victim's name a matter of public concern? Instead, we're going to say, this reporter lawfully obtained the victim's name from the police department and then published an article about a matter of public concern. And we will, therefore, we are finding, because the article itself was a matter of public concern, that the reporter cannot be lawfully punished consistent with the First Amendment.
Justice Winter, that's exactly how I read the Florida Star. My position that I was just articulating is that if you want to put guardrails on, if you want to place the limitations
that court could narrow Florida Star is what you're saying?
No, that under principles of federalism, this court can go down to, but not below the limit set by the Florida Star. I actually read it exactly the way you just described. But if the court had the concerns that Justice Patterson articulated, you can say, well, all we know from the US Supreme Court is it can't be a smaller nexus than that. And if it is, then it's got to be okay. I'm finished, Judge.
Would you agree that if the relevance or relation is fairly debatable, that a prudent records custodian should not release the information and let a court make that call? Because courts in civil discovery, for example, are constantly deciding, you know, is this request sufficiently related to the issues in the case? Wouldn't the prudent way, even though it might result in some interim restraint on publication, be to let a judge decide that close call rather than having 500 or more records custodians try to make a quasi-legal judgment?
Judge Sabatino, on the one hand, I agree with you 100% that, of course, we would want judges rather than other people making those decisions. But I actually think you're reading too much into it, which is no one has suggested that the records custodian couldn't. The question of public interest doesn't really come into the initial disclosure. The question is, once it's been disclosed, can the government threaten civil and criminal prosecution for repeating what you got? And so, but we did come to court, right? One thing that Mr. Cradiville could have done is he could have published and then challenged. But we came to court to say, hey, we have this emergency. We think this is a prior restraint on speech in violation of the First Amendment. And here we are 20 months later, hopefully getting closer to a resolution of
that
matter.
I wanted to make sure I understand. So you're not arguing that a records custodian might be required to release information whose release is prohibited under Daniel's law because that information is related to a matter of public significance or some reporter alleges that it is. You're just saying if the record custodian releases it and the reporter puts it in an article or wants to put an article that is itself the article about a matter of public importance, the person cannot be constitutionally punished for doing that.
That is exactly right.
So does that mean that the subsection A, in the civil, not the 2C person, subsection A proviso or condition that a person not only ceased further disclosure, but then must in some way, not described, remove the protected information from the other internet or where otherwise made available? Are you hinting at or suggesting that this removal obligation is unconstitutional as applied? I'm having a little trouble myself conceiving if the reporter then disseminated it, what at that point could be done because it's out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably refers to taking down the website. I mean, there was a recently reported case in Mississippi where a newspaper was ordered to take down an editorial.
How efficacious is that?
So efficacy aside, and I think it's a very important question, I think the efficacy questions are kind of run through this conversation, but in this as-applied challenge, it's not the
we're not there yet because there hasn't been an accusation made that there was conduct by your client that where he was obligated to do something affirmative to take back what he already had.
That's right.
But it seems like that would be something that would arise, you know, frequently with when these requests are made or when there's some partial disclosure made.
And so I want to just pick up on a word you just used, which is arise frequently, a phrase that you just use, arise frequently. I think it's important to note that Daniel's Law has been around since 2000, in its current iteration since 2020 and 2023 is the current iteration. This is the first time this has come up. So it's not that this is going to open the floodgates to the dissemination of information, because most often it's going to get stopped at the initial disclosure stage. And so the idea that
great faith in that, right? Why wouldn't someone be motivated to simply ask for do a mass open request of municipalities for the home addresses of police officers, chief of police, any judges who happen to live in the town, and see if any mistakes might be made?
I have no answer to why they wouldn't be motivated to. What I have an answer to is that it hasn't happened yet, that we've had 5 years of experience and it hasn't happened yet.
Well, and it wouldn't violate Daniel's law unless each individual person had opted in, correct?
Right.
So there's no automatic provision of Daniel's law. Each individual person has to fill out the required information, request that their information not be provided in response to a request, et cetera.
That's exactly right. And
the disseminator must be provided notice under Daniel's law to initiate any potential violations, if not taken down or
what. Also sure, what we've been calling.
So there's a lot that has to happen to trigger Daniel's law provisions.
So if there were OPA requests en masse to all 500 and some municipalities, unless people had opted into Daniel's law, presumably those records custodians would be required to produce all that information. And
yes,
what is so far a unique situation for Mr. Cradiville could become a very substantial situation with respect to Daniel's law.
That's plausible, Justice Patterson. I can't doubt that it's plausible. It's also not the situation we have. And we have an as-applied challenge where one person in the last 5 years has gotten this information from the government, happens to be a journalist, happens to want to write about a matter of public concern.
Why would that be an issue under Daniel's law? If the individual members of the government who could be protected by Daniel's law had never opted in
and it's
no requested issue. Protection, then whoever wants can get their information under OPRA and publish it however they want to, because the person is not protected by Daniel's law unless they specifically request protection, correct?
That's correct. There might be other provisions probably of Title IIc that would prevent the just kind of mass dissemination of home addresses under doxing provisions, but that is not what we're talking about here, since you know everyone agrees that there's at least this adjacent matter of public concern. I'm going to quickly move to the other elements. They should be really much quicker. No one debates that this matter is true, that he received the actual home address of Director Caputo. It's also not really a matter of debate that Director Caputo's home address was widely available in July of 2023 when we appeared before the Middlesex County Superior Court, and that it was lawfully obtained. We've had some discussion about whether Mr. Cradiville gave what is arguably bad legal advice. That doesn't make it not lawfully obtained. The cases on this are clear, whether we're talking about both Bartnicki and the Pentagon Papers case, where there was actual illegality, just not illegality by the journalists, or whether we're talking about cases like the Florida Star, where there was erroneous disclosure. That doesn't, and the reporter in the Florida Star broke the rules, knew she wasn't supposed to write it down, and nonetheless wrote it down. That doesn't change the Daily Mail analysis. It is still lawfully obtained. So that then gets us to the narrow tailoring inquiry. And again, just to reiterate what I've already said, there's no doubt in this case, we have not challenged that this is a government interest of the highest order. The question is about narrow tailoring. There's some suggestion by the city that we should defer to the legislative choices, but the essence of a narrow tailoring inquiry, as the U.S. Supreme Court teaches in Ashcroft, is that we don't defer to legislative choices, and we actually ask whether there are alternatives that could roughly equally satisfy the government interest. And so I've talked about the first one, and the Florida Star is very clear about this, that when the government affirmatively gives you the information, courts must make the assumption that they had a better way to prevent publication other than subsequent criminalization or civil penalty. They didn't. And I talked about auditing, I talked about training, and I talked about criminal penalties, none of which are found.
Let me pause you on training, because training would be, it would essentially say, it would be training that would say that if this particular individual had invoked Daniel's law and gone through the process, you should not produce that in response to an OPRA request?
Correct. It would say that when you get an OPRA request that includes in it either a home, the answer is either has a home address or an unpublished phone number, you should check that record against the Daniel's law database to decide, to figure out whether this person has opted in. And if they have, you don't turn it over. And if they have not, you do turn it over.
I thought Daniel's law actually redacts the information in the government databases to begin with. So maybe it wouldn't even be the custodians to hand over.
I don't think that's true in this case, Justice Wainer-Apter, because it would be hard for that information, the home address, to be redacted in a voting record where it's so central to, right? Are you in the right precinct and district? So I don't know. You might be right. But even assuming that it's not redacted in the government record itself, which might be the case, the training is pretty straightforward. It's not hard. And like I said, we know with expungement, we tell clerks, if you disclose this erroneously, you are looking at a fine. This is what they were talking about in GD v. Kenny. And no such provision is found in Daniel's law. And there's also auditing. Are we checking? And so, Justice Wainwright, if you're correct that it should be redacted in the original material, then that's a clear place where the government could be auditing.
Is that all those things were implemented? Your position, though, is if the releaser makes a mistake, the court must honor the journalist's entitlement to publish something they lawfully obtained.
That's correct.
With no balancing done at all. It's happened, got out. We're stuck with that.
I think there's always a balancing, Judge Sabatino.
What are you balancing, though? You said that these are the measures that the government has at its disposal. We took them all. Unfortunately, something got out that shouldn't. So what's the remedy available to deal with it to protect the privacy of those that have registered?
So maybe I misspoke when I said there's always a balancing. Let me say, there might be a balancing. In Ostergren, the Fourth Circuit case that I cited to, this is about the widespread dissemination of social security numbers.
Can you provide the citation, sorry? Or just the full case name, Ostergren?
Ostergren, O-S-T-E-R-G-R-E-N. And I'll provide the citation during rebuttal. In Ostergren, the question, Virginia had social security numbers on all sorts of property records. They had them in the basement of their town records rooms, and they put them online in unredacted form, just a mass list of social security numbers. And so a privacy advocate said, just to show Virginia how silly they're being with privacy, I'm going to publish exactly what they've given us on the internet. And the court in Ostergren said, listen, there might be a different test if the person is going into the basement rooms to find these social security numbers. But here, where the government is making them readily available on the internet, then they can't constitutionally prohibit her from doing so. And so too here. We might have a different case if Mr. Cradiville had been scouring the dark web to find Director Caputo's address. It was the number one hit on Google. It wasn't hard to find, and he got it from an Oprah request.
So you're saying that any balancing would refer to what the journalist had done or needed to do in order to get the information?
I would look at it
as the circumstances that somebody might be, that someone on the other end of it might be experiencing. For example, somebody who's under an active threat, requiring security and so forth.
So I would look at it, the balance, in a slightly different way, Justice Patterson, which is I would look at the steps that the government had taken to safeguard the information. And so if we learned that they had done many things to safeguard it, but someone found the archived edition from 1984 of a home, that might be a different case. But again, since we're in an as-applied place, we don't have to ask that. We just have to know that all Mr. Cradiville had to do was send an Oprah request or go on to Google, right? In many ways, the Oprah request just confirmed that which was readily available to anyone who had a search engine.
None of these Supreme Court cases that you are discussing in the Daily Mail line of cases or others about when someone obtains information from the government, lawfully obtains information and then publishes it, none of them considered the privacy of the home, which the Supreme Court has acknowledged is granted, quote, special consideration in our constitution, laws, and traditions. How is that relevant to this case?
I don't think it's true. The privacy of the home matters, but so does the fact that someone is a victim of a crime. I mean, and particularly that crime, and which is to say sexual assault. And at the time, just to be clear, the perpetrator in the Florida Star was at large when the Florida Star published that article. Right? So there were real safety concerns for BJF. And the court didn't find that any of those trumped the First Amendment principle. So Justice Wainwright, I can't deny that the home is entitled to special solicitude. I just don't think it changes the First Amendment analysis.
We did recognize that in State versus Ramirez, I believe, right, with the defense wanting to get access to the victim's home address and we put, there were guardrails placed on it because of those special considerations, right?
Without a doubt, special considerations. And in Ramirez, the court also found that there were ways that the defense could access that. And so we're not suggesting that willy-nilly people lose an expectation of privacy in their home address. Instead, we're suggesting that under these peculiar facts, Mr. Cradwell has a right to publish. If I can get to the second narrow tailoring failure, which is the exception that exists in the federal Daniels law. So the federal Daniels law, the very law which members of the federal judiciary lobbied for their own protection, makes an exception for exactly this situation. For instances where the information was provided and is reported in a news article or an editorial on a matter of public significance. I think they did so because they thought it was constitutionally compelled, but whether they did or didn't, the federal Congress thought that that was a sufficient way to protect federal judges. And there isn't evidence that it is insufficient here in New Jersey. And the final piece is the criminal versus civil. I'll just say a very quick word on this. The Attorney General suggests that the criminal piece of Daniels law is not before this court. That is plainly wrong. It is before this court, first of all, because we pled it and we're at the stage where we're relying on my pleadings. But beyond that, the letter that Mr. Cradwell got that told him that he couldn't do this anymore, that he had to not talk about the home address anymore, first of all, it cited both the civil and the criminal provisions. And second of all, it copied the first assistant county prosecutor in Middlesex County. It is quite a stretch to think that you would copy the prosecutor on a civil-only notice. And if that isn't enough, just if we accept the Attorney General's construction on when the criminal law, which requires a reckless disregard for the safety of the covered person, is implicated, what they say is it can't be enough to just know that a covered person is covered.
The appellate division noted that what that letter was, I'm leaving aside the copying of the prosecutor's office, is Daniels law notice. It's what was statutorily required. Simply kindly accept this letter as written notice as required by the above reference statutes. There's no threat of prosecution. There's no threat of a civil penalty in that letter.
Well, except that it references a statute that has a threat of civil penalty, and it references a statute that has a threat of criminal penalty.
Right, but it's a reference to a statute. It's not we are going to send somebody out and arrest you.
But if someone receives a letter that says, do not engage in terroristic threats, and includes a citation both to the terroristic threat statute and the sentencing statute, one can assume that implicit in that is that if you do, you are subjecting yourself to criminal prosecution and between 3 and 5 years in state prison.
And here also there's a line that says, I trust you will be guided accordingly.
Right.
Thus implying that there is some force that must guide you.
And Justice Patterson, you left out from the hypothetical that they were copied, but Mr. Cradwell can't, right? Mr. Cradwell got this letter with copy to
them. I understand, but with the exception of that aspect to it, it seems to be what is a letter that tracks the statute.
It absolutely tracks the statute.
Interpretation by the city of what notice of under the statute should look like.
I want to be clear that when I refer to this as a cease and desist letter, I'm not suggesting anything nefarious. It is exactly what is required by Daniels law. But they invoked both the civil provisions of Daniels law and the criminal provisions. My last point, just to finish up here, the state says merely knowing that a person is a covered person cannot evince reckless disregard. And that might be true, but Mr. Cradwell knows more, because the city has introduced in this litigation evidence that they purport suggests a unique threat that that Director Caputo faces. It hasn't been subject to adversarial testing. I'm not accepting it, but it certainly exposes Mr. Cradwell to the potential of criminal prosecution, and that's enough to invoke it in the narrow tailoring inquiry in the way the Third Circuit did in Schrader.
So if the letter had omitted the carbon copy to the prosecutor and omitted any reference to the criminal side of it, you're not contending that if the requester lawfully obtains it, that they're criminally immunized at all. It's just that the problem is the coercive nature of putting that in the letter. But your client, if your client hypothetically did recklessly divulge, et cetera, the fact that it wasn't in this letter would not give them any kind of immunity or protection, right?
I assume that's right. I'd have to look a little more closely at the criminal statute on that question, which is to say, is the warning a prerequisite for criminal prosecution? But the limited point about which I'm speaking on the criminal side is when we look at narrow tailoring, as the Third Circuit did in Schrader, the question is, could they achieve the same stuff with just the civil sanctions, or do they also need the criminal sanctions? And if they don't need the criminal sanctions, then it's not narrowly tailored.
Thank you.
The AG distinguishes Florida Star on the basis that there's no post hoc liability being imposed here. So there's none of the unfairness raised by a reporter receiving information from the government and then publishing it only to be thereafter faced with a tort suit or criminal liability. How do you respond to that?
Right. Instead, what the reporter is faced with is a prior restraint. This is, right, the First Amendment hierarchy, this is the thing about which we worry most, telling reporters what they can't do before they've even done it. And that's what we have here. And so it is different than Florida Star. And Justice Patterson, you started my colloquy about the Florida Star by saying the facts are different. It is, but it operates as precedent. And we have to be guided by that, first in how it defines the issue of public concern, and also in how it looks at narrow tailoring.
And on that issue, you're asking us to stop at Florida Star and not go to Snyder? For the issue of public concern, because you're suggesting that we're not looking at the specifics of the content, the context. You're asking us to stop at Florida Star?
No, I'm not suggesting that you can't look at Snyder. I think Snyder is very helpful to us, right? In Snyder, the context was a funeral, something that is deeply private and personal. And they said, notwithstanding that, the overall thrust of the message of the Westboro Baptist Church, the overall thrust of their message was on issues of public concern. Here, if you look at the context, it's a news article, right? The very pinnacle of the hierarchy of First Amendment rights. And so I think Snyder is extremely helpful for us, but I think the case can be resolved just on the Florida Star.
Do you agree with the trial judge's characterization of the state interest of the highest order here? Was homicidal attacks or threats upon judges, law enforcement officers, or prosecutors, or members of their family is a state interest of the highest order? And he went on to say it would be hard to discern a state interest more compelling. You are not contesting that.
Correct. Justice Manorapta, did you have a question?
In terms of Snyder, the court looked at the overall thrust and dominant themes of the sign and to then ask whether it could be fairly considered as relating to any matter of political, social, or other concern. So it didn't specifically say, this sign, because it was not related to a matter of public concern, there can be intentional infliction of emotional distress damages based on this sign, but this sign, because it is a matter of public concern, there can't be damages related to that sign.
That's exactly right. In fact, the court looked at all the signs. It identified two signs that they thought were particularly personal rather than public, but said that the overall thrust of the signs in general was sufficient. And that's exactly that is consistent with the analysis in the Florida Star, that we're looking not fact by fact, but at the broader issue. Unless there are any questions, ask the court to reverse, and I'll be back for
rebuttal. Thank you for having me back on rebuttal. Mr. Corrado.
In enacting Daniel's Law and in preventing the disclosure of home addresses.
Yeah, I agree that the legislature has the right to make that decision, but that doesn't answer the question of whether a newspaper or a court can say that this sort of information can be in a news story or not in a news story.
It's your argument. Is it still your argument that you don't believe that this is an interest of the highest order?
I defer to Mr. Shalom on that. If he's conceded that or is arguing that that it is not, I don't have a problem with that. My client's concern here is that this court make it clear that courts cannot say what should be or not should not be in a story.
Well, they
can't make that kind of determination without intruding
contrary to the Tornillo line of cases, into the First Amendment protections that the press enjoys.
Well, respecting constitutional values, though, there are still limited areas, right, where courts can constitutionally second guess editorial decisions if they're made, for example, in reckless disregard of the truth, that sort of thing.
Of course.
So the New York Times versus Sullivan, I mean, the editorial room is not completely sacrosanct. And
I certainly don't disagree with that.
Except, you know, able to autonomously decide all these things. There's a level of tolerance that our system has here with free speech and editorial judgment versus countervailing public value. So it's not like there is an inability of the legislature or the court to intrude in certain instances on those decisions, right?
I couldn't agree with that more. But there's a big difference in my mind between a court deciding whether a newspaper has published with reckless disregard of the truth and a court saying you can put this information in the story, but you can't put this information in the story because it's not necessary to tell the story. Those are two entirely different things, Judge Sabatino, in my opinion.
What about troop locations at time of war, for example?
I'm sorry.
What about troop locations during wartime?
Versus Minnesota, of course not. But that goes to the question of whether the case or the action of the state rises to a level that satisfies the Daily Mail test.
But if a court were to rule in a case like that, a hypothetical case like that, and simply say that in order to explain to the journalists that there is a story that can be told here, that the journalist can report on the comments of the soldiers or the experience of the soldiers or whatever it is without revealing the location, that is very similar to what was done here. I mean, it's trying to state the standard in a way that allows the journalist some guidance as to what can be reported.
Well, but that's not what happened in this case. What happened in this case is that Mr. Crotteville has essentially been told that he will be punished in some way. And I heard the dialogue between you and Mr. Shalom about what was in the letters and back and forth. But I happen to think that correspondence was a kind of a veiled threat. But in any event, Mr. Crotteville was essentially told here that if he published, he would be punished. That's different than a court engaging in saying, if you do this, this is not the kind of interest that couldn't be a prior restraint. It couldn't be restrained.
But I don't think the court that went that far. I understand that's an interpretation, but that's not what the appellate division said. And it's not what the trial court said.
Well, the trial court said specifically that there's no logical reason for this information to be in this story. It doesn't add anything to the story. And it's just not a court's job to make that kind of a determination. And my concern is that if this decision is allowed to stand the way that it was made by New Brunswick and affirmed by the lower courts, I think that it creates kind of a slippery slope or raises real concerns that are going to chill journalism. And I urge this court as part of its opinion in this case to make clear that kind of intrusion of a court into the editorial process cannot be tolerated because it does violate the constitutional protections that the First Amendment gives to the press.
And you mentioned the First Amendment. I just want to clarify something I didn't ask Mr. Shalom. You're additionally arguing that under Article 1, Paragraph 6 under the New Jersey Constitution, I thought you were. Well, maybe I'm wrong.
No, you're not wrong at all. As a matter of fact, I think our principal argument is under the New Jersey Constitution.
Now, and what is unique or special here under, we have factors, state versus hunt, the times when New Jersey can add to the protections that are available. Why in this case should this court determined that there's even greater, no matter what the national landscape is under the First Amendment, that there's something unique about New Jersey's protection of reporters that warrants a different outcome?
I, I, you know, I don't think that I can articulate as we stand here today a reason why there should be any additional protection as there was in, say, the shopping center cases or the condominium cases. The Twin Rivers case participated in. But certainly, as Mr. Shalom made clear, the federal constitution is a floor, not a ceiling. And this court has the ability to say that New Jersey reporters are entitled to more protection against in court intrusion into the editorial process. I'm not so sure without going further back into the facts and the record that I can articulate a specific reason why.
And I didn't see that in any of the presentation. Mr. Shalom. I thought what we were being asked to do is apply the Daily Mail line of cases. There's also an invocation of our constitution, our state constitutional provision.
I believe that is correct.
I just want to understand that is the argument.
I believe that is correct. And the argument was made that the Gede versus Kenny case essentially adopts that line of cases into New Jersey law as part of the New Jersey constitutional.
Any other questions?
I'd like to make one other point, but it's not strictly media related. I think that the appellate division in the lower court got the burden of proof wrong in this case, backwards. This is a constitutional challenge to a restraint on speech. And therefore, it's not the restraint is not presumptively valid. As a matter of fact, the burden is on the state or the city in a case like this to prove or to demonstrate that the proponent that as the proponent of the restraints, they have to demonstrate the propriety of the restraint.
This is a facial challenge against a statute that the legislature passed and the governor signed. So there's a presumption of constitutionality that applies.
Not when but the way in this is an as applied constitutional challenge to the way in which the city is imposing Daniel's law on Mr. Prattville, or attempting to, or proposing to impose the law on Mr. Prattville. And therefore, I believe that the burden is on the city to justify the restraint. And the appellate division and the lower court essentially said that Mr. Prattville has the burden of showing that the inclusion of the home address is necessary for the story.
So whose burden is it to prove that as applied to a particular setting, as we have here, a statute is unconstitutional?
It's the burden of the city in this case. The city's burden in this case is to prove that exclusion of the store of the home address is necessary to protect the interest that it advances.
Do you have any authority on that?
I do not, other than the general principle that when First Amendment that when restraints on speech are challenged as unconstitutional, the presumption is flipped.
Does the fact that we have here a statute change that? It's an unusual
what we have here is a case where the statute is proposed to be applied. This is as we've made. I hope we've made clear. This is not a facial challenge to Daniel's law.
No, I understand. Okay. No, I understand. It's an as-applied challenge. But whose burden is it to prove the unconstitutionality of a statute as applied?
If the constitutional challenge is one that involves a restraint on speech, it's the burden of this the proponent of the restraint.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Shalom's request that the court reverse.
Thank you.